Welcome to another episode of the Insight is Capital podcast. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Director at AdvisorAnalyst.com. Today, as you can see, we have the pleasure of hosting Bob Elliott, the co-founder, CEO, and CIO of Unlimited Funds. Unlimited, founded in 2022 by Bob Elliott, Bruce McNevin, Andrew Solomon, and Matthew Salzberg, is pioneering the use of machine learning to create low-cost index replications of 2 and 20 style alternative investments, such as hedge funds, venture capital, and private equity. Their first product, the HFND ETF, was the fastest growing independent active ETF launch in the US in 2022. In 2023, Unlimited launched its Agile strategy, offering the desirable features of a multi-manager fund with significantly lower costs and better liquidity terms. Before founding Unlimited, Bob served on the investment committee at Bridgewater Associates, where he developed investment strategies across various asset classes, including equities, fixed income, credit, exchange rates, and commodities. Many of these strategies are used in Bridgewater's flagship Pure Alpha Fund. Bob also led Ray Dalio's investment research team for nearly a decade, authored hundreds of Bridgewater's daily observations, and provided counsel to top policymakers and institutional investors on economic and investing issues. In addition to his work at Unlimited and Bridgewater, Bob has been an advisor and executive at several startups, including Circle Up, where he revamped the investment strategy for their $150 million venture funds using big data approaches. We are excited to have him here to share his insights and experiences. Thank you for listening.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Bob, welcome to the show. I'm very excited to have you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. That's quite a quite a read into my showing up. Hopefully, I can live up to that bio.
I have a feeling that you will. To begin, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to talk about your time at Bridgewater, which must have been a fascinating and formative opportunity in your career. What brought you there and ultimately led you to attaining the executive role of leading Ray Dalio's investment research team? And what was it like to work with Ray Dalio and company?
Yeah, I mean, starting my career at Bridgewater was a great way to build sort of a deep, rich understanding of how the macroeconomy and markets and systematic investing work all sort of together. My academic training is actually in history and in botany. And so I actually didn't take much in the way of formal economics courses in college. But right. I was involved and interested in public health issues and increasingly sort of recognized that macroeconomic issues connect to public health issues. And so went to Bridgewater with the idea of sort of getting a paid master's degree in, you know, macroeconomics. Now 20 years later, you know, I'm still doing it. And part of the reason why that is because, you know, I think that macroeconomics are fascinating both because they're a great way to understand the world in the same way, you know, the principles of physics are fascinating or chemistry right. and the way the sciences are. And in addition, there is so much that we don't know that every day you can learn. Like there's reasons why, you know, people will continue to trade markets, you know, long into when they could easily be retired. And that's because it continues every day to be, you know, to have so many questions, so many things to understand. You can never just become great, you know, perfect at trading markets, right? You'll always be learning. And so that makes it a very compelling thing on a day-to-day basis. I think, you know, my time at Bridgewater, I think the biggest thing that I learned was, and developed the skill around was basically this idea of taking what seems like a big, complicated, discretionary world of different things that are happening, that a lot of people in the world engage with on a discretionary basis. They essentially like open up the newspaper every day or the equivalent and kind of take a guess at what's likely to transpire. But right. when you look through that world, what you see is that there are fundamental things that are going on, ways in which the world operates, the way people operate. And so if you can take that understanding and you can write that down, quantify it, measure it, you can have a lot of edge in the market relative to those people who are, you know, either engaged in the markets in a way that they're not even really considering, you know, the prices and the dynamics that are going on, or doing it in a discretionary way. And so that's really been a foundational tenet. You know, I describe myself as a systematic investor for 20 years, and that's really at its core what the skill set that I've developed.
The longer you're in this business, the more and more you realize how little you actually know. To quote Donald Rumsfeld, known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. I mean, that you know, that pie of knowledge, you know, what we know as individuals is this thin sliver of, you know, known knowns. And then there's a wider sliver of known unknowns. And then there's this gigantic, you know, rest of the pie, which is the unknown unknowns. I'm always fascinated by that because I find that more and more, the more we speak on this show with luminaries in the industry, the more we realize, you know, how humbling this business is, how surprising it is on any given day, and how fascinating it can be to be able to, you know, dig into it and come up with the answers and come up with some solutions or some directions on what to do next as events unfold.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way you can tell someone, you can tell someone who's been in the asset management business and particularly, you know, managing money for a long time, is like the more humble they are, probably the more experience they have. Right. And so I love talking to like old grizzled traders who will just, you know, they will give you a litany of all the times that they have lost money. Right. And that is a, and these are people who are wildly successful in their careers, have been doing it for decades. And nonetheless, you know, they feel the pain of learning on a day-to-day yeah. basis, because yeah. and that I think is one of the greatest challenges, but also like one of the greatest opportunities of being an investor is that it's very hard, but nonetheless you can constantly be learning. And part of the key game in investing is not just figuring out a way to create edge, which is challenging. It's not to say that that is an easy thing to do, but it's to be able to trade your edge consistently day in and day out to get enough sample size to do it for long enough that you can prove out that edge over time. And so I think that's one of the key things when I think about whether it's building a savings portfolio and how do you diversify appropriately so you don't react in times when, you know, certain market environments emerge, or whether it's in more alpha trading strategies, where how do you create a system where you actually trade your edge day to day and don't get distracted by what are totally normal emotional responses to if a position's losing money or a new piece of information is coming out that you might be overweighing, like all of those things. It reflects the fact that it is a mental game as much as it is a skill game in order to actually do this effectively over time.
You co-founded Unlimited in 2022. What was the thinking behind that? Can you elaborate on the vision and the mission behind Unlimited? What inspired you to democratize access to alternative investments for individual investors? And how do you see this impacting the broader investment landscape in the future?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was as a, you know, in the 2 and 20 business, I've been in it for 20 years. And during my later time at Bridgewater, as well as when I was on the private side of the 2 and 20 world, doing venture capital investing, sort of increasingly realized that 2 and 20 strategies, you know, they're great for the manager and they're not that great for right. the investor. And the reason why that is the fees are too high. And for US based taxable investors, the taxes are also typically pretty bad too. And so you sort of put that together, and I started to think about, you know, was there a way to sort of bring concepts of diversified low-cost indexing that obviously totally have changed stock and bond investing and made investors much better off today than they would have been otherwise? Could we bring that to the world of 2 and 20? Because, you know, when you look at that 2 and 20, for most advisors, you know, what you see is there's been this push to sort of increase access to alts in lots of different ways, platforms and things like that. But almost all of them are increasing the fee problem, not improving the fee problem. And what we need to do is give people more access with lower fees. And so that's where we had the idea, the inspiration to basically say, instead of trying to invest directly in these products, you know, use our experience and, you know, we've got decades of experience in the 2-in-20 space with modern machine learning approaches and basically build technology that replicates how these managers are positioned at any point in time. And then we can package those into financial products that are much lower cost, more liquid, more transparent, because, you know, instead of having to pay, you know, highly paid PMs that are making discretionary or proprietary decisions, you know, we're using technology to basically figure out what they're doing and can charge a whole heck of a lot less.
You're using advanced machine learning techniques to replicate the returns of alternative investments. Can you walk us through the development process of this technology, how it ensures accuracy and reliability in replicating these complex investment strategies? How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, any good investment strategy or technology sort of starts with a common sense intuition. And that intuition is basically, if you look at a manager's returns and you basically know what they're doing from a strategy perspective, and you know what's happened in the markets, you could probably have a pretty good guess as to how they must have been positioned during that period, right? And I'm sure, you know, everyone's done this where they've looked at the manager's returns. They're like, oh, I know you're an equity long short person, so you must be, you know, you outperformed the index, so you must have been overweight tech during this period, right? And right. So what we're doing with our machine learning approach is basically taking that concept, that core idea of, you know, eyeballing the returns and backing out what must be happening, and just running that on a more systematically rigorous basis. And the way that we do that is we look across the major hedge fund style strategies, and we compare the return outcomes that we see in close to real time with market performance and back out how managers must have been positioned. And I think one of the key things, the key insights, is that positioning is continuous, right? You don't, particularly no one manager and certainly no collection of managers are flipping day to day their positions long and short. It's not how you do it, because you can't do that. Otherwise, you'd incur exorbitant transactions costs. And so you can actually get a lot of information value on what is the highest probability portfolio that managers are holding today, based upon the path of returns, which creates a path of probabilistic portfolios that must have described the returns over time. And so essentially what we do is we run a sophisticated Monte Carlo simulation. Computationally, wasn't really even the techniques as well as the computational capacity was not really commercially viable even 5 years ago. But, you know, with the advancements that have existed recently in technology, we can bring those techniques to bear and get a higher fidelity understanding of how these managers are positioned in closer to real time.
Yeah, I recall, you know, bloggers and writers, researchers who were going through, you know, sifting through in the past, of course, sifting through 13F filings to get that information, you know, but you're always looking backwards, right? When you look at that, you're looking backwards at what was the, you know, what was in the portfolio the last reported quarter. And for the most part, you know, hedge funds try to be as opaque as they can because they don't want copycats, right? The copycats are out there trying to figure out, okay, this is what you owned last quarter. How did that change? It's not like, so to what extent are you at all looking at 13F filings as a point of reference, or do you not need to anymore?
Yeah, I think the challenge with 13F filings is that they only provide, you know, they're lagged, as you say, meaningfully.
Yeah, and it's a snapshot.
And they only provide a window into a particular portion of the portfolio. So in particular, you know, long positions in, you know, equities, single name equities and ETFs. And sophisticated asset managers use all sorts of different instruments to express their positions. And so, and more recently, you talk about how funds want to become opaque. You know, there's been strategies that have developed to obfuscate the actual positioning of the funds as reporting requirements, certain reporting requirements have increased both in the US and in Europe. And so If you look at what's reported in a 13F versus what's the actual economic exposure, those things can diverge very, very meaningfully. And that's why we're really focused on returns, because returns are truth. If you lie about your returns, you go to jail. So, so you have, you know, they're comprehensive, they're truthful. And so we can get a much better understanding of how managers are positioned looking at that pattern of returns. The key thing is you have to interpret it in an effective way. You have to use the right tools and techniques, and frankly, have enough of an understanding of the types of strategies that are being pursued to be able to develop that technology that engages in that inference.
Right. I mean, you have to be able to reverse engineer the holdings based on the returns, the allocations to indexes, the allocations to futures and options across a, you know, the universe, right? And so that's the part that's fascinating. You know, I watched your video on the site, on the Unlimited site, where, you know, you get into explaining, you know, the distribution of returns across all these different, you know, all the different asset categories. And I found that fascinating. So how exactly do you reverse engineer based on results? How do you reverse engineer into a portfolio of assets that's allocated across asset classes?
Yeah, well, I mean, the basic idea is for each one of the different hedge fund styles, there's an opportunity set, a universe of plausible exposures. And those are pretty different between different styles of managers. So let's say you take an equity long short manager, you know, they by and large are trading, you know, stock indices, factors, sizes, sectors, et cetera. That's pretty different than, you know, say a fixed income manager who are trading a variety of different credit targeted instruments, credit and fixed income targeted instruments. And so it's really about tailoring the opportunity set. And then on top of it, when you think about that opportunity set, you know, managers don't think about assets in a prepackaged way. So they might think, you know, they do think about sectors as a concept, but you might also think about other things like, you know, high free cash flow versus low free cash flow, high debt versus low debt, different slices, different ways of constructing, deconstructing asset markets and building them amongst factors that would be meaningful cross-cutting drivers. And so what we do functionally is we look at the returns and then we look at it, look at those returns relative to that, what I describe as sort of a comprehensive but parsimonious set of plausible asset returns that are driving how they typically position, designed based upon our decades of experience having actually built the proprietary strategies. So we know how managers are thinking about it. And that's really what and then we solve for what the portfolio is that best describes it, again, in the context of the through time, the portfolios that describe all the returns through time. But that craft that's not a trivial thing to craft, because you have to build it in a way that is consistent with how managers actually think about it. And, you know, people in the past have thought about hedge fund replication, and even products that are out there on the market now, you know, might basically take hedge fund returns and regress it against 100, you know, assets. It's like, well, you know, right. Who knows? You know, and they might get, you know, they might get things that are totally counterintuitive, like, you know, 40% of global hedge fund risk is in like Chinese small caps. It's like, that's not really how it works, right? That doesn't make any sense when you're thinking about what's actually being done. So that's why it's so important when we build these things is to build based upon, you know, it's an expert directed or expert designed systematic approach. And part of the way that you can, and one of the ways that we give insight into that is we actually publish a regular, what we call our hedge fund barometer, which shows across the 50 or 60 major asset classes and sectors and things like that, how are hedge funds positioned? How is it evolving? So you can connect the sort of intuitive, you know, there's a lot of noise out in the world. You hear a lot of commentary about key themes, and then you can see those key themes reflected and quantified in our technology that we use on a day-to-day basis to run our products.
So when you're replicating When you're doing this reverse engineering that's taking place, how many different possibilities are coming out at the other end of your programming, of your machine learning? How many different possibilities are there? Like, how nuanced is it? And are there you know, wide distributions, or are they fairly narrow in terms of the allocations that get, you know, reverse engineered?
Well, the way I would think about this, it's a Bayesian process, and so functionally, what we do is we create a portfolio for the most recent return period that we're looking at to try and infer how the position right. is. We create literally hundreds of thousands of simulated portfolios that could possibly explain that return pattern, contextualized with the hundreds of thousands of plausible portfolios of the previous right. period's returns. And using that understanding, what we create is we functionally create probabilistic distributions of the portfolios based upon that. And what we actually use is basically the highest probability portfolio based upon those probabilistic distributions. And so the result of that, I think what you see is it actually ends up being a relatively intuitive understanding, you know?
Right.
For instance, like...
And it's coupled with your domain knowledge.
That's right. The systematic design and the operation is what we, approach it systematically. We don't use discretion to adjust the positions in any real time, in any real time basis. But what we do is we compare the outcomes of those to try and look at that relative to points of triangulation. There's no one else has, you know, lots of people want to understand how the hedge fund industry is positioned. No one else has developed something as comprehensive as what we developed, but we see bits and pieces around that we can use to triangulate. So I don't know if you read the financial media for a period of time, for about a year, there was a great deal of conversation about how Japanese equities were particularly attractive right. given the macro dynamics that were going on there. Well, we look at our technology and you see that actually that started to pick up the rise in positions in Japanese equities, you know, starting about a year ago. Well, I didn't say, hey, look, people are piling into Japanese yeah. equities, right? The process that we've designed identified that. So after 20 years of being underweight, we now see the, you know, we saw through the end of the first quarter, the largest overweight in Japanese equities in 25 years. And that's the sort of stuff that, you know, we can triangulate to know whether or not what we're doing is making sense with those points of triangulation. There's a lot of different qualitative and somewhat quantitative points that are out there. But we really sort of center on this basic idea of the sort of comprehensive perspective that we've developed.
Fascinating. That's truly fascinating. I like your point that, you know, your process was informing you. Right. If you go back and say, where was that moment that the process identified this trend? And, you know, that's exciting, because on your own or in a vacuum, you might not have necessarily picked up on it without having the systematic approach to do so. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've encountered in bringing alternative investment strategies to individual investors? Like, how have you addressed these challenges? And I know this is a compound question. So how have you addressed these challenges? And conversely, what opportunities do you see on the horizon for expanding and improving your offerings?
Well, I mean, we were talking about before how often, an alternative strategy, or generally prudent asset management portfolio, can meaningfully underperform something. There's always right. something that's out there that's doing better. And there's always somebody saying, hey, look, I'm all concentrated in, you know, Bitcoin, Mag 7, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, through time. Right. And that at any point in time, that looks like they are the smartest person in the room, but that doesn't necessarily mean that what they're doing is prudent asset management. And part of the story with alternative asset strategies in general, and I'd say hedge fund style strategies in particular, is hedge fund managers are not you know, they sort of have this view that they're like wild and crazy trying to generate huge returns. Like most hedge fund managers are like, are trying to very prudently manage capital to generate stock-like returns right. with meaningfully less risk and lower correlation. That's what they're trying to do. And that's, they're pretty good at it is the reality. And particularly if you reduce the fees, they're very good at it, at doing that. But that also means that they are always underperforming whatever is the thing that's going up the most.
Right,
and I think that's right. the core challenge is helping bring people along from this idea that, say, you know, try and chase the highest performing thing to instead try and build the most robust portfolio that can that has a whole bunch of different things diversified in a way that you were always catching the thing that's going on the uptrend, but not over betting on it so that you know, pay the price on the downside.
Yeah, this is the idea behind all weather strategies. I think you know, the thing that gets lost in all the sizzle about hedge funds that seems to be generated by the media and you know, by the space itself sometimes, you know, especially when you read about the big wins that some hedge fund managers have from one period to the next, you know, the John Paulson, you know, big short stories. Right, those are the complete outliers in the industry, you know. So that's what people tend to think about when they think about hedge funds. But in reality, you know, the client of the hedge fund, the wealthy individual, is not trying to hit the ball out of the park every year. I mean, that's not their key objective, as you rightly said. Their key objective is to sustain and maintain and preserve the wealth that they have invested, the wealth that they have given, you know, and entrusted to the hedge fund manager. So hedge fund managers are not trying to hit it out of the park. If it happens, it's wonderful, you know, as a byproduct of investing, but it's not the objective. The objective is to provide a smooth ramp for growth and have a host of you know, a selection of uncorrelated assets working together as a team in a portfolio. You know, that's the part that often gets overlooked is, you know, when you see, like, why do high net worth investors gravitate to hedge funds? Because they've discovered, you know, I can get 6, 7, 8, or 9% consistently forever by going with this particular hedge fund or this particular strategy. Or I can sometimes get 25% in a year, you know, in some years, and, you know, lose 15 or 20 in another year, in other years. So ultimately the objective is to reduce the drawdowns and to maintain the consistency, the robustness of the portfolio over all periods. So that's the problem that advisors have, you know, is that, while, you know, they most likely understand, you know, all that we're talking about, theoretically, it looks great, you know, on paper and in discussion but in practice, it comes down to, you know, your client's neighbor is the genius who owns, you know, a humongous overweight in Bitcoin this year, right? It's like, well, why don't we own any of that? Or why do we own so little of that? And so that's, you know, that's interesting. That's definitely the key problem. You know, you see across the industry now, the rise of all-in-one funds as well, right? Where, you know, you're starting to see asset allocation strategies starting to incorporate the CTAs and the hedge fund strategies, the long short equity components, merger arbitrage event driven, all these different strategies are starting to get wrapped into asset allocation strategies more broadly. And it looks more like a risk parity or balanced asset allocation strategy than the old, you know, balanced fund. And, you know, so that seems to be another way that line item fatigue, that line item risk, is getting addressed, and where advisors can say to their client, you know what, we're not going to have these discussions anymore about why do we own this. It's all going to be in this one solution over here. and you don't have to, you're not going to have to worry about how that single, those individual line items are performing in your portfolio every time we meet. So in that regard, are you seeing uptake in your space where other strategies are picking up your product, your strategy, and making it part of their internal allocations as well, as part of the, you know, institutional investors looking at, like, I think the part that's fascinating about what you're doing also is that you're bringing the 2 and 20 strategies to the market without the 2 and 20, right? with the low cost basis for doing it and getting the same results. But when you net out what the fees would have been versus what your chart, you know, versus what you've built into your replication strategy, more of the benefits of the hedge fund strategies goes back to the investor.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, I think the challenge that all investors face is that the cost of fees are certain and the ability to generate differentiated returns is uncertain. And so, you know, what I like to say is what I'd like to do is, you know, track the positioning of, you know, the smart alpha managers that are out there, you know, essentially the equivalent of hiring, you know, tens of thousands of hedge fund analysts without them knowing, just by looking right over their shoulder, and then creating fee alpha in that. And the beautiful thing about fee alpha is that fee alpha typically is quite durable in the sense of, as long as you can continuously be lower cost than other options that are out there, that is a direct benefit to the investor. And what I also emphasize is that the tax burden is also a meaningful part of the story as well. You know, most investors right who invest in LP structures of, you know, public markets managers, hedge fund managers, are paying, are essentially forced to pay at their income tax rate on an annual basis, right, whether they liquidate the position or not. And that, you know, that can be not a trivial cost relative to packaging those exposures into something that predominantly takes, you know, can predominantly take long-term capital gains. And so it's really about, you know, the lower fees and the lower taxes and the right more liquidity and the better transparency, all of those things put together. Because what an investor really cares about, they don't really care about what, you know, what the manager's returns are when they look at it. What they care about is the net of fees, net of taxes, net right of advisor fees, you know, all in cost that they're, you know, all in return that they're getting. And so if you can improve that, particularly if you can improve it reliably, through structuring more efficiently and reducing fee cost, that actually puts you in a much better position, even if you can't replicate or deliver right the same exact alpha that would otherwise exist. You got a heck of a cushion there if you can do yeah the other things well.
Yeah, I think that's that. You know, that is a very big idea that is under-recognized. You know, it's not. You know, on a quarterly or annual review, an investor's looking at their outcome, they're saying, okay, we made all this, you know, we made all these returns across all these different strategies that we've invested in, that we've allocated to, but what's my net? And so that's where you come in. That's where your solution comes in and provides that extra, that extra net return, net of costs, net of taxes. Those are the logistical returns that investors don't think about at the outset. They only think about them once the process is underway, right? And when you're actually building a portfolio, and you can make those comparative analyses across, you know, a portfolio that owns partnerships, hedge funds through traditional means versus what you're doing, you know, versus HFND, you're going to end up with similar results on the return side, but on the net side, it is where some of the big difference is going to be.
Yeah. Right? And I think,
I mean, that's a very big idea. I think that's a very big idea across the industry that gets underregarded. Yeah. And
it's interesting because I think, if you go back 50 years or something like that, I think, you know, people said about stock investing and bond investing that, they didn't recognize the benefit of, you know, low cost diversified products in those spaces. And obviously we've come a huge way over the course of the last 50 years, both with explicit true, you know, low cost indexing, but also I'd call it sort of index adjacent approaches. Right. You know, there's lots of great successful products that are out there that are maybe focused on, you know, high free cash flow or high dividend or things like that. But they're all centered around this core concept of high access, low fee for a product that people can put in their portfolios. But if you look at the 2 and 20 space, it's almost like people view it closer akin to a luxury good rather than a returning asset, where, right, you know, the greater the lockups, the greater the fees, there must be something there, right? That I would love to pay, you know, 7 and 30 and have a 5-year lockup in order to get access to a particular name that I can go tell my friends at cocktail parties about, right, the fact that I'm in this particular name. But money doesn't care about how you talk at cocktail parties, right?
Yeah, it's romantic.
It's romantic.
It's sexy. Yeah,
right. That's exactly right. Yeah. And so, as a simple example, you know, some of these, there's been a lot of attention paid to these multi-manager pod shops, and people, you know, seem drawn to them. But what has functionally happened is that they've raised the fees so high on those products that the net of fees outcomes for those products are equivalent to or lower than the rest of the industry. Right. And it's such a good example. You know, who's getting rich? It's not the investor. It's the manager that's getting rich. And to be clear, the government also is getting, right, rich on your products as well. And so I think that's the, you know, breaking that view. And to be honest with you, you know, there's plenty of days where I go through and where it feels like it would be a lot easier if I, you know, hung my shingle, charged 2 and 20, had a 5-year lockup, and, you know, ran a traditional asset strategy because of that tension point where people in this corner of the market really think that expensive is better. And that's, right, just not the case.
Like a Giffen good.
That's right. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
It must be better if I have to pay more for it.
That's exactly right.
But exploding that myth is the key here. Bob, with your extensive experience in that space, in the hedge fund space and asset management, how do you perceive the current trends in the alternative investment space?
Well, I know this will connect obviously to what I'm doing right now, but look, big picture, if you take a step back, there are $700 billion in fees earned by 2 and 20 asset managers on an annual basis. And while there's, wow, been sort of very on the margin changes, like I say 2 and 20 in the hedge fund space, it's actually like, you know, 1.65 and 14.7 is really what the right number is, but, right, that's marginal. Like basically this business, the 2 and 20 asset management business, looks the same today as it did 40 years ago for investors, right? So hedge fund managers are basically charging 2 and 20, hiring, you know, people out of, you know, the best colleges, paying them a ton of money in order to generate returns that are not that great net of fees. You know, venture capitalists and private equity managers are mostly just, you know, venture capitalists are still doing the same thing, which is like highly individually labor intensive discretionary investing, where they sort, right, of like stare in the eyes of the of the entrepreneur and think that they can glean that they will be successful at understanding it. And they'll charge you for charge you 800 basis points a year for the pleasure of their totally discretionary views. Right. All of that together. Like, how is it possible that nothing has changed? What other place in this, in the economy is, are there $700 billion a year sized industries where they essentially are stuck in the same structure as they were 40 years ago? And so I think what we're likely to see here over the course of the next 10 or 20 years is a radical rethinking about the way in which the 2 in 20 industry exists, and in particular, the way in which people are thinking about the fees that they're paying relative to the returns that they're getting. And you know, interestingly enough, the most fee-sensitive folks in here in this industry are the public funds who are working on behalf of sort of the everyday common person saving their retirement and their pension. And they're seeing how it doesn't make sense to pay these managers 2 and 20 and are looking for alternatives to be able to do that. They are on the cutting edge. You know, soon that will come to other institutional investors. It will come to the advisors that, you know, are doing this day in and day out. And people will increasingly recognize that fees are the problem. Fees are the biggest challenge to building long-term wealth, more than any other challenge that's out there. And the fees are still too high.
The folks who have warmed up to ETFs are more than likely the same folks that are going to find their way to what you're proposing. And what I think is particularly interesting is this is the, you know, the movement in the industry to get investors to look at their portfolios the same way institutions do, and to, you know, widen the scope of their investments away from, you know, the traditional stock bond mix to make their portfolios more robust. And so you're paving the way for that. You know, that's not the easy route. That's not the easy, as you said, you know, sometimes you're looking at yourself and you're thinking like, why am I doing this? But it's the democratization. It's making these instruments, these investments available more widely so that more investors can actually partake of that school of thought. Where would you, when you're talking to allocators, advisors, where do you recommend they allocate for? Like, where do you recommend they fund their allocations to your strategy from their core holdings?
We started Unlimited. Part of the idea was looking at, and you might like, extensive experience working with the biggest sophisticated institutions in the world. And when you look at what they do in terms of their asset allocation, particularly on the hedge fund side of things, is they allocate about 20% of their risk to hedge fund strategies. And, you know, we could go on at length about whether that's precisely the right amount, but, you know, it mostly makes sense. It's a reasonable allocation that they do. And then the thing that they do that's super interesting is they don't pick like one or two managers the way, you know, many advisors or individual investors will pick this manager or that manager. What they do functionally is they invest in literally dozens of managers across all sorts of different strategies. And then what they do is they beat them down on price, right? If you're cutting a check for $1 billion to a manager, you say, no, 2 and 20, no way. Right. They basically, I mean, in some cases, the marginal dollar can be at 25% of the incremental cost of the rack rate. And so they essentially create diversified, low cost index products of the 2 and 20 strategies. And that was really sort of the inspiration. It's like, well, why shouldn't the everyday investor be able to have access to diversified low-cost index funds of 2 and 20 strategies the way these institutions are? And so when you think about this in the context of a portfolio, you know, in the context of a broader, say, 60-40 portfolio, et cetera, these sort of diversified alpha strategies, you know, I would look towards institutional asset allocators who put about 20% of their strategies in. And, you know, in many ways, what we're doing is we're creating the SPY or the Qs or whatever BND version of those strategies. It doesn't mean that you might not want to, you know, there might be certain managers that you like, certain strategies that you think will will outperform in a particular period of time. In the same way you might with your equity portfolio allocate to certain thematics or certain sectors or, you know, certain factors that you think are compelling at the time. So that's really the use is in that 20% bucket. We're sort of like, you know, trying to create the SPY equivalent of that bucket,
right?
The low cost index fund.
In terms of the traditional portfolio, the 60-40 portfolio has been identified as being 90% equity risk. So how much, where would you, which sleeve or how would you divide, if you were allocating 20%, reallocating 20%, how would you divide between the two traditional sleeves?
Well, I really think about, in the same way you might think about your bond assets as a diversifier to stocks. So too, in general, should you think about alternative strategies as a diversifier to stocks? Now, I think there's lots of good diversifiers that are out there that are not just bonds in terms of your portfolio, whether it's gold, diversified commodities, and alternatives all have benefit right. in creating a more robust portfolio. But all of these things are all moving along the line of how do we get less highly concentrated equity risk in our portfolios and get to something that is more diversified that from a savings portfolio in particular is something that can do well navigating a variety of different economic and market environments. And what that takes is, you know, moving away from highly concentrated equity risk to, you know, a portfolio of different diversifiers.
Are there any emerging sectors or strategies that you believe hold significant potential for growth?
Well, I think,
and why?
I think the biggest thing for most investors right now is most of them are concentrated in a 60-40 portfolio. And that sort of portfolio does very well in a disinflationary growth environment. But the types of portfolios, you know, that has been the primary, say, global dynamic that we've seen in place for the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. But I think there's a lot of good reasons to believe that that was more unusual and likely behind us rather than, you know, the likely global scenario ahead of us as deglobalization and increased conflict take hold. And so really investors thinking about how do you get away from just that sort of lessons of the past portfolio and to one that's going to do, you know, that's going to be well prepared for a variety of different macroeconomic outcomes in the future. And that's really where I think particularly higher inflation assets, because for the long-term saver, the biggest risk to your portfolio is not really financial assets going up or down. It's really inflation. And so being in a position where you're protected, increasingly protected against inflationary pressures, I think is very important as we look ahead.
Before we wrap up, Bob, where can our listeners find more information on you and your illustrious team and all you're doing at Unlimited Funds?
Yeah, if you're interested in following sort of a steady flow of what's going on in terms of the macro economy and getting perspective, you know, on those incremental pieces of information that are coming out, I run a relatively active Twitter account. It's at Bobby Unlimited. If you like it in more of a visual form, I also take clips of various media appearances and put that, as well as do monthly macro webinars on my YouTube at also under Bobby Unlimited. And if you want to learn more about what we're doing at Unlimited, definitely check out unlimitedfunds.com, where there's lots of information about our technology. Check out our hedge fund barometer, which shows that sort of real-time position of how hedge funds are positioned today. That we make available on a regular basis as well.
You got a terrific blog too.
And you can also sign up there for our blog where we make regular commentary about sort of key investing topics as well as commentary about what's going on in the hedge fund industry specifically. So that is a lot of different places, a lot of different ways to take advantage of the content we're creating.
Well, I'm enjoying it, Bob. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation.